Hello, I'm Richard Suchet, and this is the LBC Daily Debrief, the podcast that brings you the full story on the day's biggest news, and we begin here.
How has she responded to the Russian government's request for a sample of the agent used in the Salisbury attack to run its own tests?
Jeremy Corbyn has come under fire in the House of Commons by Tories and Labour MPs alike for querying the Prime Minister's response to the Salisbury poisoning nerve agent Russian spy incident scandal row, whatever you want to call it. But is he being unpatriotic or is he simply holding the government to account? We'll get into that one in just a moment. Plus, police detectives investigating the Grenfell Tower blaze have found that one of the fire doors resisted fire for half as long as it was supposed to. We'll hear more from LBC's Rachel Venables about that. And a council in England is considering using empty houses to provide homeless people with postal addresses to help them access public services. We'll speak to the architect who came up with the idea. Now, Jeremy Corbyn has come under fire again in the House of Commons for his response to the Salisbury poisoning incident. Critics accused him of being lukewarm on the issue, while supporters heralded his demand for due process. He stated, "Our response must be decisive, proportionate, and based on clear evidence," adding, "How has she," i.e. the Prime Minister, "responded to the Russian government's request for a sample of the agent used in the Salisbury attack to run their own tests?" Fellow Labour MPs went on to sign a letter condemning the Leader of the Opposition's response, and Shadow Defence Secretary Nir Griffiths this morning stated, "We very much accept what the Prime Minister said. This is a very sophisticated nerve agent and that Russia is responsible for this attack." She also urged that Corbyn had made his position clear in a tweet posted last night. "The attack in Salisbury was an appalling act of violence, which we condemn in the strongest terms. The Russian authorities must be held to account on the basis of the evidence, and our response must be both decisive and proportionate." But could Jeremy Corbyn be accused of being unpatriotic, or is he simply holding the government to account? Well, I'm joined now by James Bloodworth, author of Hired, and Ali Fogg, freelance writer and journalist. Ali, Putin's goal, I think we can all accept, is to sow division, not just in our country, but in the West as well. And Jeremy Corbyn is pretty much buying it hook, line and sinker, isn't he?
I don't think so, no. I don't see any evidence of that at all. I think what's happened is that the Leader of the Opposition has attempted to do his job over the past few days. He has attempted to clarify and bring some transparency to what the government's policies and positions are. He's attempted to clarify and bring some light upon what actually happened in Salisbury, how it happened, why it happened. And I think if the leader...
Sorry, Ali,
the
is that the role of the Leader of the Opposition?
Or
absolutely. When there are appalling acts of violence like this, is it not the Leader's opposition to actually choose the right moments to stand by the government?
Let me be clear. This is absolutely the right moment for the country to know that we are being led properly and correctly and sensibly. It's not exactly ancient history since the country was last led catastrophically astray by bad intelligence and, if you like, a kind of collaboration between the government of the day, the intelligence services of the day, and the media.
I feel like you're conflating two very, very different issues.
2002, 2003, when the weapons of mass destruction was going on, which we all remember vividly.
Well, we know a nerve agent has been used this time.
I am not saying for a moment, allow me to finish, I'm not saying for a moment that Russians are not involved in what happened in Salisbury, or that Putin isn't personally responsible. I've seen very little evidence to suggest any other theory would be acceptable. But what the country must do, and what the Leader of the Opposition must do, is hold the government responsible for doing what they must do, and that is observing the due process of international law, being honest with the country, being honest with Parliament, and if the Leader of the Opposition is not allowed to bring up topics like, for example, the involvement of Russian money in British politics, then we are simply not talking about what is happening here. We're not talking about what the potential solutions could be. If the Labour Party is not allowed to raise issues such as the supply of radioactive materials from the UK to Russia, then the Leader of the Opposition is not doing his job. So I think what's being asked here is basically the acquiescence and the obedience of the country and the Labour Party, when there is very, very little reason to have confidence that such obedience and acquiescence would be the correct thing to do.
James, what do you make of that?
Well, I mean, acquiescence and obedience to what? I mean, Theresa May's proposals proposed retaliation, if you like, to the poisoning of two people in Salisbury has just been to expel some diplomats. I mean, my problem with Labour's position on this isn't that Jeremy Corbyn is unpatriotic. It's that some of the questions he asked, for example, the idea that we should, you know, send the sample to Russia and let them decide whether they're guilty of a crime that they appear to have committed, it's just an irrelevant response to it. And people are suspicious. I mean, I think some of the reaction to Jeremy Corbyn's statement has been over the top. I mean, I thought it was slightly weak, and I thought it was brought up irrelevancies, as I've just mentioned. But I think the suspicion falls on Jeremy Corbyn over this stuff, because you have Seamus Milne putting out press releases on it, and Seamus Milne backed the Russian annexation of Crimea just a few years ago, and made excuses at the time for why Putin definitely didn't murder Boris Nemtsov outside the Kremlin around the same time, and at the same time has back in 2013 was attempting to muddy the waters over whether Bashar al-Assad had used chemical weapons on the Syrian people. So I mean, obviously if you have someone like that in your role of director of communications, people are going to think that you may be, for want of a better phrase, shilling for Putin. I don't think Jeremy Corbyn is, but I think there's an image around him because of some of the people he surrounded himself with. And questions such as whether we're going to check with Russia whether what they think the chemical agent is, that this is just an irrelevancy. This chemical agent originates in one place, in one chemical production facility in Russia. Russia was asked so show us how it got into someone else's hands and ended up in Salisbury, and they refused to do so. So, I mean, I think their guilt is very much clear at this point.
Ali, even the Daily Mirror headline, I'm looking at it now, it says, Jeremy Corbyn is not a traitor, but he's doing a very good impression of being Vladimir Putin's friend. He's just misjudged this, hasn't he?
I think James's reply to your last question sort of revealed what's actually going on here. People, I mean, I'm not particularly a fan personally of Seamus Milne and his own politics going back many, many years. But given what James has just said, I struggle to imagine what Jeremy Corbyn could have possibly said in reaction to the Salisbury incident, to which James Bloodworth would have not said exactly what he has just said. He's basically saying that whatever Jeremy Corbyn says, we will attack.
That's not what I've said at all.
It is, James. Be honest.
Jeremy Corbyn said we need to get permission from Russia to decide whether this is a chemical agent they've used or not. Why did he say that?
I honestly have no idea. I mean, I think what he was trying to do is ensure that the government had gone through the proper international procedures as laid down by the protocols on the use of chemical weapons.
They've already submitted that request to the agency.
Sorry, can I just add one point?
Yeah, sure.
There's a deeper issue, which is that the way in which the commentariat, if you like, the kind of the political establishment, have focused in on every nuance of every word of every sentence of what Jeremy Corbyn has said. If you do that, you will reveal, you know, you'll throw up some odd anomalies or some strange wordings or some strange questions. You know, they've even gone to the extent of using Seamus Milne's quoted words from off-the-record briefings to hold that against him. If the media and if the political establishment actually did its job, which is to apply the same level of scrutiny and interrogation to what Boris Johnson is saying, to what Gavin Williams is saying, and what Theresa May is saying, you would find far greater number of strange statements, odd remarks, weird asides, and we could go through all of those and reveal a government that's actually thoroughly incompetent and is failing to deal not only with the immediate diplomatic crisis that's unfolding before us, but has failed to deal with the security of the country going back to 2010 when they amongst many other cuts to security services and the police, they also abolished the chemical weapons crime investigation department. Now, none of these stories are the focus of the media's attention. No one in the media is asking what Theresa May and her government and the previous government since 2010 could have been doing to make this event less likely. Where is that level of scrutiny? Why is the level of scrutiny that is being applied to Jeremy Corbyn, the leader of the opposition, not being applied to the actual blooming government?
Well, I can only say that this is Jeremy Corbyn's own fault for surrounding himself with people who categorically supported Russia's annexation of Crimea, Russia's invasion of Georgia in 2009.
Except you're not...
Seamus Milne, let James finish. If you surround yourself with people like this and then you get lukewarm statements containing ludicrous questions about sending the sample over to Russia in the Commons, then it's inevitable that people will focus on this rather than some of the other important things. And I agree that Theresa May, her response hasn't, I don't think it's been strong enough. I think Russia can, you know, we'll do this tit for tat thing now and expel some of our diplomats. It won't really make any difference. They're not going to come down hard enough on some of the money, the dirty money spilling around the City of London.
Can I finish? I wanted to ask, James, what do you think the government's response should be? Should they be launching missiles?
Well, I think, no, I mean, this is, like, who's saying this?
I'm genuinely asking, I'd like to know what it is you're proposing.
The evidence is overwhelmingly that Russia's guilty of doing this. So I think clean up the City of London, get some of the dirty Russian money out of the banks in the City of London, crack down on the property owners. Labour's not been proposing this. The Magnitsky Act is fundamentally weak. It doesn't say some of these things. It's much more watered down than that proposal was originally. But first of all, I mean, we have to, if you're going to muddy the waters that there's no real evidence that Russia had done it in the first place, then we're not going to get anywhere, which is what it appears that people like Seamus Milne are trying to do.
I don't think they do. I think you're saying that they're doing that, but I haven't seen any evidence that they're actually doing it at all.
Seamus Milne put out a statement yesterday saying that we weren't sure... Seamus Milne put out a statement yesterday saying that we couldn't trust the intelligence agencies on this.
Yeah, do you disagree with that?
I believe that the intelligence agencies are telling the truth on this more than the FSB in Russia, which Seamus Milne...
Can we trust them without question?
Who's saying without question? I believe them on this. Does that mean I believe them on this? Do you? Do you believe the intelligence agencies or the FSB? So do you believe the FSB before our own intelligence agencies?
I don't believe either of them 100%. I think
that does rather sound like you see them as kind of, you put them in the same bracket. Really.
No, only because James asked me the two of them together. Mm. I mean, I think the FSB is probably the most dodgy international intelligence assassination, murderous, barbaric organisation you could find anywhere. And no British... No arm of the British state anywhere approaches what goes on in Russia and what Russia does. But that doesn't change the fact that I do not unequivocally support and believe what British intelligence service tells me without question every time. And as I read Seamus Milne's words yesterday, that's exactly what he was saying too.
All right.
And listen, I want to know if James disagrees with that.
All right. I've got a feeling.
I disagree that it's an appropriate response when there is categoric evidence that Russia did. It was Russian poison used in Salisbury. I think that's, I mean, there is a time and a place to start questioning. But they haven't provided evidence of who did. I mean, if my gun that only I have access to is found at a murder scene and someone asks me, how did it get there? And I just greet that with bluster, then I'm going to look pretty guilty. And I'm not going to start questioning the police and saying it's their fault.
Guys, listen.
When that happens,
I've got to interject.
Should be a trial. Should there be an investigation and a trial when that happens?
I've had the time to go out and make a cup of tea and come back, and I thank you both very, very much. Why don't we take it to Twitter?
You.
Twitter seems like a good place to carry
on. No, I can't be bothered with Twitter.
No, I know what you mean sometimes. Thanks very much to both of you. James Bloodworth there, author of Hired, and Ali Fogg, freelance writer and journalist. Thanks to both of you very much for taking the time to speak to us here on the LBC Daily Debrief. Now, coming up, a council in England is considering using empty houses to provide homeless people with postal addresses to help them access public services. We'll hear from the architect behind the idea. But first, police detectives investigating the Grenfell Tower fire have found that one of the doors resisted flames for half as long as it was supposed to. LBC's Rachel Venables is here to tell us more. And as I often tell people when we hear you reporting about Grenfell, Rachel, is that you were one of the first reporters on the scene on that awful, awful night. You've been following the story ever since. What's the latest?
Well, the latest has come from the Metropolitan Police and the team of detectives actually investigating this fire, the cause of it, the problems surrounding it, and of course the deaths of those 71 people who lost their lives last June. Now, we haven't had too many updates from the Metropolitan Police in regards to this investigation, which of course is 9 months and counting now. But this update has come directly, and it was sent in a letter directly to the people affected by the fire itself. So people who used to live in the tower, people who lost loved ones, received a letter from them dated yesterday, just giving them a bit of an update. And it has caused some real concern, both with the residents. Obviously, it's caused a lot of upset, and with other people as well up and down the country. Essentially, what they've done is they've taken a number of doors from Grenfell Tower, fire doors, and they've tested them to try and see how they would withstand against the flames.
Replica ones, presumably.
No, actual. They've taken an actual door. So obviously, probably from lower down, you would assume, because certainly the lower floors only have water damage. They were fine. They escaped the worst of the flames. So they've taken a door and they've tested it. Now, the way fire doors work, they are obviously meant to be very solid. They're meant to be secure. They're not meant to allow smoke to get through, etc. And they are meant to withstand the flames either for 30 minutes or 60 minutes. They're the two main specifications. The Grenfell Tower doors were 30 minutes, but in the tests, they only lasted 15. So they were half as good, much lower, the police said, than they were expecting. And of course, that caused some real concern, and it adds to the problems that we've already seen with the cladding, the combustible cladding on the outside, and the combustible insulation as well.
Well, I mean, I'm an amateur, what do I know? But it seems to me that the role of cladding and insulation is to insulate you,
yes,
and not to save you from flames and fire. And yet there has been so much fuss, rightly so, don't get me wrong, about cladding. But a fire door is actually there to protect you from fire, and it seems to have failed the tests. So I wonder if this will in some way shift conversation away from cladding. I guess an impossible question for you to answer. But what has, have we had any reaction from the government?
We have, yes. So we heard from Sajid Javid earlier this morning after this was announced by the Metropolitan Police midway through the morning. Sajid Javid stood up in the House of Commons and he gave this update to MPs as to what had been found and what's being done about it.
This investigation has involved a thorough examination of every aspect of the tower, including front doors to flats within the property. These doors include a glazed fire door manufactured around 5 years ago. Initial inspections indicate the door is believed to have been designed to resist fire for up to 30 minutes, but when tested by the Metropolitan Police, failed after approximately 15 minutes. The Metropolitan Police considered that this test result might have wider implications for public safety and alerted my department.
So after his department were alerted with this rather worrying warning, he says an expert panel were brought in. They carried out their own wider reaching tests. And apparently, he says, the advice to the public is the risk on this is low. Nothing needs to change. It's not as though they've highlighted a real risk that goes beyond Grenfell Tower. And he's also stressed the need not to jump to conclusions when it comes to the actual root cause of the problem.
I should stress that in carrying out these tests, conclusions should not be drawn about the nature of the cause of the Grenfell tragedy. That is a matter for a separate police investigation, and it must be allowed to run its course.
Do we know who made the doors?
We do, yes. So the doors were made, it's believed the doors were made by Mance Masterdoor. They were the manufacturer of the doors, which were installed around 5 years ago, between 2011 and 2012. Now, since then, the company's trade and operating assets have been taken over by a different company, Sinseal. And then Mance Masterdoor, they changed their name, and then that company went into liquidation. And I think what's quite interesting is Sinseal, that the company that took over, said that the products in question were no longer being sold. They've changed all of the projects, they've changed the specification of the doors, but the doors that you saw in Grenfell Tower would not be manufactured and installed today.
Well, you know, that's great that they're not making these doors anymore, but you can imagine that for the victims and, you know, the survivors, of course, are victims, that is deeply frustrating, because that is probably yet another company or another set of people that won't face any kind of prosecution or charges. We know from your fantastic reporting in recent months that there is a huge amount of scepticism about the investigation into Grenfell. Do you think that coming out with this kind of disclosure is in some way convinces the victims that as much is being done as physically possible to get to the bottom of what happened.
It certainly helps. I mean, it certainly helps from the point of view that they received this information first and foremost. They didn't hear it. There may well be some who heard it in the media, but from what I understand, certainly many received a letter from the Metropolitan Police. I've seen a copy of that letter sent to a woman whose mother lived in the tower, mother and I think a sibling as well. So for them, it really does help that personal connection with the police. And I understand for many, they actually do have quite a lot of confidence in the work that the police are doing. A lot of them do respect the police officers. Problems that they have.
Is that a shift in mood, or is that?
I think so. I mean, it depends who you speak to. It may well be that I've been speaking to entirely the survivors and the bereaved who trust the police, and no doubt there will be many others who don't have confidence in authority. Of course, really a lot of the focus has been in the inquiry itself. So that inquiry by Sir Martin Moore-Bick and what he's doing and the diversity. Of course, there was a petition which reached 100,000 signatures, and that's going to be debated in Parliament to try and make a more diverse inquiry. Not diverse in terms of race, I should point out, but diverse in terms of background. So fears really have focused on the inquiry. And while many don't believe necessarily that the police investigation will result in any convictions or any arrests, I think they do trust what the police are doing. And this idea that a police officer or the police investigation would find fault with something, a danger with something, let them know, let the government know, and the government would act, that certainly helps.
And finally, where are we in terms of the inquiry? When will we hear back? Do we know?
Well, the inquiry has been pushed back and pushed back. There have been a number of delays, I think, as they realised bit by bit how huge the investigation is, the tens of thousands, no doubts, of documents. We're in the first phase at the moment, which looks at the cause of the fire. Very early on in the first phase. There was meant to be initially, I believe, a report back around Easter time with this first phase. So cause of the fire, spread of the fire, really the stuff on the night, how the flames spread. And then the second phase will look into the wider cultural ramifications. The council, it would look at things possibly a little bit more about who installed these fire doors, who was responsible for checking the cladding, the insulation, even things like the response of the fire brigade. Second phase is going to take much longer. So really, there is no realistic expectation that this is going to be done anytime soon. It will be years before we get real answers.
I have to wonder if they kind of release this information to
tidy you along as we're going.
And to convince people that serious work is being done. Cannot be an easy task, can it? LBC's Rachel Venables, thanks very much for joining us and updating us on that. Now, a council in England is considering using empty houses to provide homeless people with postal addresses to help them access public services. Any post received to the allocated address would be redirected to where the homeless person might be staying or to somewhere where they could collect their post from. Well, I'm joined now by an architect who came up with the idea, Chris Hildrey, architect and designer in residence at the Design Museum. Chris, I like this idea, and I spend a lot of time, for various reasons, walking up and down the Strand in London, where there are a huge number of homeless people, I'm sad to say. And I always think to myself, what would I do in their situation? How would I sort of break out of the cycle of homelessness? And you start to think how difficult it is when you don't have a postal address, because you can't get a bank account, and then you can't get paid, and then you can't, and so on and so forth. So tell me about how this idea would work.
Well, yeah, so the idea is exactly that. The main problem that you face with homelessness is, as soon as the trigger happens, it's incredibly hard to get out of the situation. Now, I mean, homelessness itself is fairly misunderstood in a sense. There's this wide assumption that homelessness or people going through homelessness are so because of issues of mental health or substance abuse. In actual fact, the leading cause of homelessness in the UK is the end of a tenancy. And the mental health and substance abuse issues follow generally as things get worse. And the main issue with that is that when you lose somewhere to live, you lose your address. And with it, as you say, you lose access to services like a bank account, all the things that you need to actually get back on your feet. So the reason why you need support is the very thing that prevents you from getting it. And the real issue there is that there's been this conflation of information, if you like, over the last several years, where addresses that were invented to describe a location, to find a place in a city, they're now used to identify a person. So what you find is that if you lose an address, you essentially lose your identity. And with that, it's very, very hard to get back on the system. The way the proxy address works is it separates this idea of address from location. So at the moment, you know, you would assume that an address means you have a property. But when you buy a property, you don't actually own the address, so to speak. You have the street name and number, both of which by law have to be publicly shown. And those are decided by local councils. You have the postcode itself, which is decided by the Royal Mail. And essentially what it does is it pulls that essentially shorthand for describing a location, and it just pulls it out and makes it an abstract thing. So it separates it from the actual building itself. So it means that as soon as you do that, people who aren't in these buildings can use the address. And there's two aspects to it. One is post and one is identity. So with post, it's very easy to get a redirection service. The Royal Mail already have that structure in place. With identity, it means that then you can have the address against your name, which sort of completes the circuit and allows you to access those things that you need.
But presumably that's only if all of these various service providers are willing to buy into that system, because actually one of the things they want to know about you is that you do have a fixed address and that you are traceable in some way.
Well, to a degree, yeah. I mean, it varies from service to service. So, for instance, a driver's license you can't get without an address. Now, the driver's license displays the address, and that's used in case of, you know, a hit and run, that kind of thing. So there are complications there. But as part of the project, you know, I was very keen not to fall into this trap of naivety. I mean, I'm lucky enough myself not to have had personal experience of homelessness. So from the outset, I made sure to speak to as many people who had some kind of input into the situation. So I spoke to people who are homeless, people who have been homeless, charity workers, policymakers, and also people like credit reference agencies as well. And the thing that really that I discovered with credit reference agencies is the address itself is essentially used as a sort of linchpin for data. If you get a mobile phone contract, for instance, it's not, the address itself isn't a guarantee of collateral. You know, you might not own your property. You know, a lot of people rent. A lot of people would be on very short-term let. So there's nothing to say that, you know, you are actually traceable at that address, if, you know, several weeks down the line. It's just a linchpin on which you can differentiate between different people with similar names, essentially.
Indeed.
So, for instance, for an airline ticket, historically you used to need an address to get an airline ticket, and there was no reason for that. The whole purpose was so that if you had John Smith 1 and John Smith 2, they would be different people and differentiated. So it's just a differentiator in a lot of cases.
Brilliant. Chris Hildrey, architect and designer in residence at the Design Museum, and the man who's come up with a really great solution for tackling a problem that is really a blight, I think, it's fair to say, on our nation. Thanks very much for joining us here on the LBC Daily Debrief. And that is your LBC Daily Debrief for today. I'm Richard Suchet, and we'll be back to give you the full story on the day's biggest news tomorrow. In the meantime, make sure to hit subscribe so that you never miss your daily update. And if you've enjoyed today's programme, please do leave us a generous review. But of course, the news doesn't stop with this podcast. Make sure you listen to LBC on digital radio, FM in London, or online at lbc.co.uk. Tomorrow is Friday. I'm excited. I'll see you then.